For the Wild podcast is brought to you in part by the Calliopeia Foundation and listeners like you. Calliopeia supports projects interweaving spirituality, culture, and ecology. We are grateful for their support and the support of grassroots contributions from listeners. To learn more about the Calliopeia Foundation, visit calliopeia.org. To make a donation to For the Wild, visit forthewild.world/donate or support us through Patreon.
Welcome to For the Wild podcast. I'm Ayana Young. Today I'm speaking with Vanessa Kavanaugh, Deb Kim Swan, and Rachel Kavanaugh.
Our country responds to our people, and the people respond back to country.
Vanessa is an Aboriginal woman with Bundjalung and Wanneroo ancestry. Bundjalung and Wanneroo nations are both located in the state of New South Wales in Australia. Vanessa is a PhD candidate and associate lecturer at the University of Wollongong in Australia. Her research explores and amplifies the experiences and empowerment of Aboriginal women in cultural burning in New South Wales. Deb is a Ngunnawal Mimini with kinship affiliation to Darkinjung and Awabe country. Deborah currently works for Transport New South Wales as a culture and heritage officer, specializing in preservation, traditional land management practices, and women's cultural practices. Rachel is a Minjungbul woman from the Bundjalung Yogambe nations of southeast Queensland and northern New South Wales. Rachel currently works as an Aboriginal Partnerships Liaison for Forestry Corporation of New South Wales and is the Principal Cultural Heritage Advisor for Currie County Foundation. Well, Vanessa, Deb, and Rachel, to begin, I wonder if I might ask you each to briefly introduce yourselves as you wish.
Nanyanyayo Bulamang from Bunungar Jagun. My name's Rachel, and I'm from Fingal Heads, far north New South Wales. I am a Minjungbul Yugambeh Bundjalung woman, and I've been working in land management for over 20 years now, and across different agency, government, and private property. I have a passion for my culture and country and empowering Indigenous people, but also Indigenous women, to take their role and leadership in looking after country using culture as their grounding.
Hi, my name's Deborah Swan, prefer to be known as Deb. I'm a Ngunnawal Mimini from South Australia. However, I've always resided in Darkinjung country, which is eastern New South Wales. My father's side is my Aboriginality, Ngunnawal, South Australia, which also includes Afghani, Kamilaroi kinship. And on my mother's side, I have Polynesian, English, Scottish, and we have Polish. On my grandmother's side, I have quite a mix of nationalities in my family. But I reside on Darkinjung country, Central Coast, New South Wales, Australia.
Thanks, Ayana. Jingi Walla,
Nyanyedi Vanessa Kavanagh, my Mirang Bungam Bundjalung Dubai from Bundjalung Jagan, and Wanneroo woman. So I just said hello to you in my mother's Bundjalung language and acknowledge that my mum is a Bundjalung woman from the north coast of New South Wales, and that also my father's side of the family is Wanneroo, our Wanneroo heritage, which is the Hunter region. Yes, so as Ayana said, I'm an Aboriginal woman from New South Wales, Australia. I work in the University of Wollongong. I'm associate lecturer there teaching first year Indigenous geographies. I'm also a PhD student and looking at Aboriginal women's engagement in cultural burning in New South Wales. So it's something that I've kind of been interested in for a really long time, caring for country and having Aboriginal women involved in environmental action across New South Wales. You know, it's always kind of been male dominated over the last couple of hundred years. So trying to make sure that there's space for Aboriginal women to engage in caring for country here is something that I'm really passionate about. So thank you for having me here for this interview today.
Well, Rachel, as we
No, several months have passed since global attention was focused on the intense Australian bushfires that began in September of 2019. And I'm sure many listeners' memories are imprinted with the vivid imagery of dark orange skies and vast swaths of burning forest and ash-covered beaches. And in its aftermath, it's estimated that nearly 30 million acres caught fire and around 1 billion animals perished. But before we delve into the power of cultural burning and fire management, I wonder if you'd be willing to talk about the extent of these recent fires and how they were unlike the traditional fire season. How much of Australia was on fire at once?
Yeah, look, I'm a firefighter as well. That's another hat that I wear. And yeah, this season, it started much earlier than we anticipated, and it went for much longer than, you know, we expected as well. The fires were intense, they were hot, they were raging, they were angry, and they were moving really fast. You know, and there's many different layers that relate to why the fire season was so intense. And, you know, you can look at climate change and all of that sort of stuff to add to it. But, you know, to get down to the sort of bare bones of it, what's actually going on is there's mismanagement of land and country, and that's been going on for quite some time now. So we have all these different people owning land and putting in different land management practices that aren't specific for the landscape, that aren't specific for the species that are here in Australia. You know, all of that added, plus the severe droughts that we've had, that's created, you know, the intense fire season.
Mm-hmm. Long before colonization, Indigenous peoples were caring for and highly literate in the landscapes of what would become known as Australia. But this would change in 1788 when the British arrived. Both land and people faced brutal extermination. So what are some of the diverse histories and the cultural importance of traditional burning prior to colonization? And then can you speak to the origin of land mismanagement in Australia? When did cultural burning stop and how did it change the land?
Across Australia, we've got a very diverse country. We've got hundreds of different Aboriginal communities within the Australian landscape. So we're actually really fortunate that there's mob or communities that are still practicing cultural burning. They haven't actually lost their traditions or their practices. And then you've got down the east coast, you know, in the west coast, or where they're highly colonized sort of cities are or communities are, and that's where the culture's been fragmented and sort of stopped. You know, during the time of colonization or the frontier wars, we were told that, you know, you couldn't speak language, you couldn't practice your culture, and if you were, you were taken away, or worst case is, you know, you were murdered. So there's lots of different pressures that were put on our people as to why they couldn't manage their country, you know, cultural fire practices were suppressed and all of that. So I think we're actually lucky now that we're starting to get some of our lands back. So we're starting to be able to reconnect with our kinship and our cultural obligations to look after country. You know, 250 odd years of not burning creates a whole different type of fuel level in the forest or in the bush. We're getting a whole heap of different invasive species that actually love fire. So they're burning really hot and they're really enjoying it. So there's lots of things like that. There's also, you know, we have our cultural obligations. We've got our stories and sort of our ceremony. So we know that, you know, and I can only speak from my mob, but I know that, you know, fire law comes from lightning. You know, and we know that lightning comes with the big summer storms, and at the end of those big hot summer days, we've got these cracking lightning storms, and they're setting the bush on fire. We shouldn't be suppressing these fires, but we have to in this contemporary, you know, day, because we do have a monopoly of species or a build-up of invasive weeds. So we're not actually able to continue and just watch that fire go or walk with it, because there's so much fuel build up underneath that it can't naturally progress. But, you know, if you want to look at how to sort of, you know, start managing land properly, in an ideal world, I'd love for, you know, people across Australia to start engaging First Nations mob to come and care for country. You know, we know our own land. We know what's needed. We know what has to be implemented for country to start responding again. And that means fire in our landscape every year, not looking at the Western world or, you know, Eurocentric practices implemented in Australia where it doesn't work, where you can't burn country for 5, 10 and even up to 20 years. There was never a thing for our people. We were constantly burning, and we were burning for lots of different reasons. We, you know, it was never just for fuel production. We would burn for ceremony purposes. Men and women would burn for different reasons as well. It was for hunting, opening up the forest, getting rid of bad spirits that were stuck in the messy forest. So there was a number of different layers attached to why we would implement fire across our landscape. And, you know, it happened at different times of the year, and we always used our seasonal calendars or, you know, the weather to help us move that fire through the landscape.
I'm hoping we can transition to a conversation on the tremendous non-human kinship networks across Australia. And I don't even know exactly where to begin because there's so many threads to be tended to. But Australia is home to over 300 native species, with nearly 250 of those not found anywhere else in the world. That being said, many of these relations are being pushed to the margins of existence. During the bushfires here in the West, we heard stories of hawks intentionally spreading fire further to drive out their prey, wombats strengthening their water holes for others, and of course, the possibility that one-third of the world's koala population perished in these fires. So I'm wondering if you could share with us what happened to animals and how are they faring in the aftermath beyond what was reported in the headlines.
That topic's really hard on our heart. Sorry. It's very heavy on our hearts because it's like losing our elders. One thing with cool burns, when we do a cool burn, our plants and animals know cool burn. They know cold fire. They know the smell of smoke. When you start a cool burn, it's like one ignition point. There's no chemicals, no fuels, no contaminations. Our people did traditional burns where they started fire with rubbing sticks. So there was no brought in material, pure, clean, cultural cool burns with white smoke filtering through the landscape, finding its way where it needs to go, cleaning up the areas it needs to do, and sending back invasive natives or weeds where they need to go. Our animals have time to, they know that smoke and they know to get away, climb up a tree, off they go. A cool burn does not enter the canopy. It might go a few metres up a tree and go out. The whole difference between a cool burn and hazard reduction burns and wildfires that take off is the contamination of fuel. There's no time for the animals to get out of their environment to a safer area. Koalas have time to climb to the top of the canopy. They know they'll be safe. They just wait a minute. The smoke actually regenerates our plants and cleanses our trees. You can see the leaves stretching down and inhaling and taking up the smoke. It's like they're singing. If you could just tap in there, we do have machines these days that you can tap in and listen to our plants and animals and how they're feeling and reacting to the environment. And you can hear them literally sing. So our plants and animals have time to move. And animals like that can't fly, like koalas and things like that, will have go to the top of the canopy. When these fires come through, they were stuck, they were burnt, they were singed. We have horrific stories of people hearing screams from the forest, of animals climbing out for protection, to climb up people and to get to water. It was devastating. They're our elders, they're our kinship, they're our mob, they're our family, and we lost thousands and we couldn't help them. Our landscape will regenerate, our animals will regenerate. We have lost a lot of animals, as we have since colonisation, but it'll be a very slow repair. We knew this was coming. We've been fearful of these times of wildfires coming. because we're watching our environment slowly dry out. And with all the mining activities here that have total rights over our water, over humans, our continent's drying out even faster. And one thing that made tension this time was, where are you getting the water to fight the fire from? And the other thing that we talk about is the language. We don't fight fire. Fire is a spirit that is always been used in Australia. It's a different language. Hence why we say cultural fire practitioners, not firefighters. You don't fight the spirit, you work with the fire.
Now, Rachel, in my mind, cultural burning exemplifies some of the consensual and caring forms of kinship we can have with the land, as well as the profound ability to be literate in the land and what it needs. Can you talk about the very practical application of cultural burning in terms of the use of strategies like cool burns and pattern burning? How does pattern burning protect topsoil and wildlife alike? And how are the cultural burns nothing like the roaring images of fire so many of us conjure in our heads?
Yeah, the cultural burning or cultural fire practices are very different to the traditional hazard reduction burning or fire regime that different agencies and people put in. So when you look at an agency and they're in there and they've got to burn, you know, 11,000 hectares this winter, and so a lot of issues are resources and people and all of, you know, the issues that everybody has. So they're putting in massive lines of fire. So they're walking with a drip torch and they will walk 100 metres and put a whole solid line of fire in that 100 metre. They'll walk a little bit and then they'll put another line of continuous fire for another 100 metres. Now, when you do that, that actually starts creating its own atmosphere and it's drawing in the oxygen and it's moving really fast. And so the idea of doing that is burning, you know, the outcome of putting in that type of hot fire is that it moves through, it burns quicker, burns really hot, so it gets rid of everything. But in the meantime, everything's dying, nothing can get away, and it's just a really hot fire to get rid of all the weeds. So there's no real healthy outcome from that. When it comes to cultural fire practices, the actual fire regime or the practice of putting in cultural burning is it's low intensity spot ignition or mosaic burning style fire. So you put one spot of fire in and you let that move. So you know one ignition spot, which could be, you know, the size of a tennis ball, that's your spot of fire, and it's a slow process and you just watch it burn. The flame isn't to get, you know, any higher than sort of your knee. And then that means when it slowly moves through the forest or the bush, across the grass, wherever you're burning, you're able to walk right behind that flame and you can actually put your hand in the soil, move the ash off the top of it and move that, you know, just that very fine layer of soil off the top of the ground. And the dirt underneath it is cool. The insects are still moving through straight after that fire has gone on. And so having these cool, low-intensity fires, it allows our kin or it allows the animals to move through. It's not hurting the plants. It's not killing because it's so hot. It's actually, you know, the tufts of grass are still there, you know, like all the leaves might have gone, but that healthy tuft of grass is still, you know, green and ready to sprout again. We have a lot of our species of trees and stuff that actually need fire and smoke to germinate. So if we're not putting the right healthy good fire in our landscape, then we're not getting our native species to come back. You know, the animals are fearful, so they take off and they're not coming back. You know, whereas the cultural fire allows that natural flow and that natural movement of, you know, plants and animals to be able to still do their thing without having to be impacted by it.
Will you hear me? Will you hear us? us up from the slumber dam that's come. Wahoon, wahoon, wahoon. Some know not what they do,
not what they do.
Some are not connected to you. Wahoon, wahoon, wahoon. I will spend the rest of my days learning the ancient ways to stay connected to you, to get connected to you.
I'm noticing that some climatologists suggest that much of Australia will become too hot and dry for human habitation in the next couple of decades. And I can't help but wonder what increasing drought, high winds, and temperature mean for future bushfire seasons. But at the same time, I'm hearing from you all that Australia needs fire. The land knows fire intimately and ancestrally, and that cannot be denied. So what would you say to those who suggest that the fires of the future will be so different than the ones of the past, that cultural burning may not be enough?
You know, that is true. The fire season is increasing in its length, like the fire season time throughout the year is getting longer. It's fire season is starting earlier and finishing later. You know, the temperatures are getting hotter and the climate is changing. So, yeah, the Australian landscape is changing. But I think, in fact, it means that cultural burning is needed now more than ever. And that's kind of, you know, that goes along with that, the climate change, but also the human expansion. You know, our urban expansion means that there is increased risk with the residential areas, you know, people's homes, our buildings and our assets. There's that increased interaction between, you know, built areas and the natural world. And so all of those fringe areas need to be really effectively managed. So cultural burning can add to that effective management of those areas. And if you couple, you know, that environmental need with the continuous like experiences that Indigenous people have around, you know, the social experiences, unacceptable low life expectancy levels, you know, low employment and education statistics. They're all kind of outcomes and representations of the failures of colonization for Indigenous people. So if you imagine, you know, if we could do more cultural burning and this then in turn created more jobs for Indigenous people, like, and that creates economic sustainability and it creates environmental outcomes and, you know, positive environmental conservation. And it also creates cultural pride and strength for Indigenous people. So in that way, it's like it's a win-win. But to achieve this, we need to have, you know, there needs to be radical change. So we need to have Indigenous people all over the country being able to access and care for country, and so that we can maintain our cultural pride and strength, and that we are healthy and our behaviours are sustainable. So, and it's not just Indigenous people, like there's an opportunity to share it with non-Indigenous people too. Like Indigenous people in Australia only make up 3% of the total population, and there's lots of country that needs to be cared for. So there's a lot of work and opportunities for everyone, and that's, you know, two-way knowledge sharing, environmental management techniques that involve Western science and Indigenous science. So, you know, there's opportunities there for non-Indigenous people as well.
Now, Deb, during the bushfires, many were critical of Australia's continued aggressive expansion of fossil fuels and coal mining, citing that these events are set to become norm should government officials and policymakers continue their, quote, no regrets strategy. It seems clear that the country is in the death grip of a power-hungry few. So I'm curious to hear what you think it will take to push these leaders out.
It's slowly happening. The community's coming along with the Aboriginal community and, you know, in concern to the environment. And together, we need to make our governments accountable. We put them in these places. We need to do something. I often say, why aren't we standing them down if we're all upset and we've all put people in the powers to be? We're the people that put our government there. We need to do something and stand up and go, no, we are not happy. And it is the people, and it's been... I mean, I don't always agree with the media. It's not always the truth or what's going on. But seriously, there's more people overseas owning Australia than Australia. And water is a big issue here. It's one, Australia's the driest continent in the world. Yet the issues that we have here over water. And we have to have treat Australia as a whole like every other country and like the world. Together, we have to look after each other. We can't work in silos. Australia can't just work in states. Everything that happens at the top end of Australia affects the bottom end of Australia. The things that happen in the Northern Territory affect my people down the bottom in the South Australia, because that water system flows right through our country. And as people are having irrigation licenses and stripping out and contaminating our water, the reports that we just got about the use of water and coal mines in the Hunter Valley was just shocking and over the top of the amount of gigalitres of water that are wasted to one mine that take from all the people and agriculture and food. It's serious, and the government needs to do something now. This planet will not last. If we don't do something now, this planet will not last our grandchildren.
I do think it's our responsibility, and I'm really glad that you're speaking to that. And now, Vanessa, in an essay titled For Aboriginal Peoples in Australia, Fire Flames a Sense of Perpetual Grief, you write alongside Jessica Weir and Bimee Williamson, quote, how do you support people forever attached to a landscape after an inferno tears through their homelands, decimating native food sources, burning through ancient scarred trees, and destroying ancestral and totemic plants and animals, end quote. And several Indigenous protected areas along Victoria and New South Wales were lost to the flames. Hundreds of sacred sites, some thousands of years old, were burnt, and countless more than human companions were lost. And so I can't help but think of the power of attachment to land, even after it is beyond recognition, and some of this attachment comes from a certain ancestral or spiritual familiarity. So I'm wondering, how is the present-day mismanagement of land a direct and violent assault on spiritual connection?
Yeah, look, that's right. It's... Aboriginal people, you know, experience that grief in a multitude of ways. But I also want to acknowledge that, you know, I mean, there's two ways to look at answering that question, and that one is that Indigenous people have this ongoing right and responsibility that we were saying, you know, this to maintain our own cultural identities, but that takes agency as well as that responsibility, so the ability to care for country. And the destruction that those megafires caused along the coast, that isn't immediately going to diminish or remove Aboriginal people's connections to place. Like, that connection will stay there. But there are, like you said, those values and landscapes, you know, things in the forest, those heritage sites, they've been damaged and many of them have been destroyed. So it's a real wake-up call. And I think, you know, Indigenous people have been talking about warning against that environmental destruction for as long as I can remember, and probably for as long as colonisation's, you know, happened here in Australia. But this year we've kind of seen people a lot more interested in Aboriginal, you know, cultural knowledge and especially around fire, you know, looking at how Aboriginal people cared for country using fire, and if there's value to be able to instill some of that knowledge into the mainstream fire regimes. And in, and another thing is, I think the cute and cuddly koalas, you know, there was a big focus on koalas this season, and that brought out that emotional reaction to the fires. And that was something that the whole of, you know, Australian population and probably overseas as well were aware that the fires were, you know, they say, oh, Australian bush needs fires, but then you see the koalas that are decimated, or, you know, all those native animals that are killed. And it's like, yeah, they need fires, but they don't need that fire. That's a really bad fire. And for Aboriginal people, you know, those animals, so those koalas, for some of them, they've got totemic relationships with those koalas and all other species that are, exist out there in nature. So for Aboriginal people, it's not only just the loss of sites, but it's also the loss of those family members. You know, it's that family member grief. So it's very kind of real and personal, as well as losing those Aboriginal sites in the landscape. So there's that, and there's also the disempowerment that Aboriginal people experience from not being able to care for country, and that's been an ongoing thing through colonisation, and I guess that can be really exhausting too. So wanting to care for and maintain, you know, healthy country and our own self-determining identities, but there's this kind of foreign imposed restrictions. And we hear about Indigenous people who for thousands and thousands of years have lived in and off the ocean, for example. You know, they're saltwater people, they live close to the water, and that's been their livelihoods. And that's been the way that they've been for thousands of years. But they're now being prosecuted for maintaining their cultural practices because it goes against the mainstream fishing laws that have been imposed against them. So that's a real spiritual assault. You know, that's an attack on who they are as saltwater people. And that then, you know, those restrictions then manifest into negative, like direct negative health outcomes and negative health factors for that community. And then that can, you know, flow on into negative social factors and negative environmental outcomes. So there's multiple layers to those impositions. And then, you know, that kind of, in terms of fire, that ripples out into the wider society too. Like, fires don't discriminate. They affect, you know, everyone in the community. So the smoke plumes hung across major cities for weeks here, and people couldn't breathe, and there were people who were hospitalised, you know, and where the fires were active in towns and, you know, those places, it didn't. Fires don't care whether you're rich or poor or middle class or working class. They're just going to affect everybody. You know, it doesn't discriminate. And everybody kind of picks up the bill for that, those damages done, you know, through the different, you know, insurance premiums or just, you know, just the effects on places that they care for, you know, wanting to have nice national parks and such. So fire affects everybody, and we all need to be kind of working together to improve fire management here.
Now, Deb, you shared with us that a significant part of your thesis was around Indigenous epistemology and ideologies, specifically in terms of the importance of reciprocal research methodologies when working with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. You write, quote, "The positioning of the researcher and the participants is vital before the research can take place, because participants are not something to be studied, but are themselves active participants, researchers in the process," unquote. And I'm thinking about this sentiment in terms of traditional ecological knowledge. How many restoration and conservation efforts seek to extract knowledge? So I wonder if, in context of fire management, you can speak to the necessity of Indigenous designated roles. Is Australia successfully doing this?
In some areas of Australia, we have really good rangers. So rangers, where we call them rangers, where they work on their country, work in their country to manage country, and that is all their management underneath that umbrella. So their cultural burns are used to manage country, monitoring their landscapes, identifying new plants, writing down the medicinal and the stories that go with them, plants. And over the years, there's times where a lot of our knowledge has just been taken, written into books, and then we have non-Aboriginal people delivering our knowledge. And it gets changed, or it's not exactly what our elders were telling in the first place. And then our elders are still sitting out in camps, not being acknowledged for their knowledge they've shared, not getting paid. We have people out there sharing their knowledge, flying all over the place, getting, you know, writing books and getting accolades and money and economics and status from our people's knowledge. Over the years, people have made sure that we've put policies in place to not for copyright on Indigenous knowledge systems. And another thing, as in right now with the cultural cool burns, and part of what the National Fire Stick Alliance in Australia are doing, they're trying to make sure that we are respectful to our elders and where this knowledge has come from, and that they're included in all the papers and policies written, and that Aboriginal people are included in the cultural burns on the ground, and that we stay included in this process. And at this moment, that's our challenge now, is working together. We have to all work together across all land management. In Australia, we have like local land services and water and agriculture, and then biodiversity, and then your bugs and, you know, your insects and all that kind of thing, where we all need to work together, understand Aboriginal land management. And it seems over the years, it's not till we have a catastrophe or something goes terribly wrong that people then turn around and go, hang on a minute, these Aboriginal people are trying to tell us something. He's going, maybe we should listen. We shouldn't have to get to a point where something so terrible happens that people will then want to listen to us when we've been trying to talk the same talk for a long time. And it really devastates our elders when they have a cultural responsibility and obligation to look after country and they're not allowed, or they've got to stand aside. It breaks their heart. It's like watching a child go rogue that you're not allowed to look after or take care, and you know what the end consequence is going to be. A lot of our elders have been frightened about what happened in November here, that it was going to come, because they're watching the fuel build up and the change in our environment and the plants that will ignite, very, you know, our eucalypts and things like that, that will ignite in a high burn. And it's important that our elders are acknowledged for that.
Collectively, it seems like much of your work is dedicated to the empowerment and experiences of Indigenous women in cultural burning. And I'm so grateful that you all continue to do that work so passionately. And I'm wondering, how have women played a part in cultural burning across New South Wales, and why does this need to be revitalized? What does a gendered lens reveal about the ancestral tradition of tending fire?
Yeah, look, that's a really great question. And I'm coming at this topic from the perspective not only as an Indigenous woman, but also as a researcher, and just looking at the history. You know, Aboriginal women or Indigenous women were just as present and involved in caring for country and involved in the landscape prior to colonisation as what Indigenous men were. Like, there was no inside, you know, we were always outside. And that involved tending to country, you know, teaching children and future generations, you know, caring for elders, caring for the landscape, so that we had what we needed, and that we, you know, we were maintaining our resources that we needed just to survive. So we couldn't have survived in Australia. It's the driest inhabited continent on Earth. So we couldn't have survived here for thousands of generations without that expert knowledge and practice. You know, we wouldn't have survived the ice ages or those dry times without being present and active. And for women, you know, women, Aboriginal women, Indigenous women, we were a part of that. And for many of us, fire was a big part of that, as a, you know, a caring for country, a landscape management technique. So women have wide-ranging roles in country. And I just find through my work and through my research, I want to be able to support and maintain that connection into the future, because I think that that's something that we need as people, and that's what's going to sustain us as a culture as well into the future. Yeah, that's what my interest is.
We even like to when we explain cultural cool burns, it's like a feminine spirit. It's like a spirit of its own. But as far as women and men's burns, there's certain areas in our country in Australia and part of our culture that has men and women areas, gender specific. There's community areas that are, it's like a four levels of a story, if I could explain it that way. So when you're a child, the first level of the story is like community. Everyone is to learn that story. It's the beginning of your learnings, and you learn the basics of life and being and working with your environment. As you grow and you learn, you're given more information and more knowledge that you are able to cope with. And then you delve into areas of strictly men's business, women's business, and there's areas that contain strictly women's sites and women's plants. And that is our role and our duty to take care of those areas and nurture and look after those areas. We do community burns together with children, but we also do, you know, women do their burns and men do theirs in areas that it's for our safety. A question that was asked before about us reinvigorating the burning, there's areas across Australia that have never stopped burning. Some communities, the closer you get to Sydney, to the nerve of colonisation in New South Wales, is where our culture gets disintegrated and where things have been stopped because we had to for survival. One day we were very healthy, gathering, eating our natural foods, and the next day we were confined to missions. We weren't allowed to eat. We were given sugar flour tea. We weren't allowed to speak our language, practice our culture, or sing our, or dance our songs. So we had an abrupt change to our livelihood and our health.
And this is a big question. You know, it's really important to have our matriarchal back out on country and managing land through fire. We use fire, women use fire for a lot of different reasons to men. You know, we hold the story and the lore of our people and our kinship connections. And so when it comes to putting in those fire regimes or when to burn or and all of that sort of stuff, it's definitely something that the women would start, and they would give the knowledge and the you know, they would pass that on to say, you know, now's the time for this. We had our stories about our medicine and you know, women's law and women's ceremony. So at those different times, fire were used as well. But I think it's really important to state that, you know, like for such a long time, women's voices and practices were suppressed for such a long time. And I know that a lot of our women and our matriarchs took a step back because it is a very patriarchal society. So our women did that. So our people as a whole, our First Nations, all of our black mob had a voice because the patriarch would only listen to the men. So we did take a step back in that to allow our people to have a voice. But now that that's all sort of changing again, the women are starting to take their roles in the matriarch society that we've always sort of lived in. And it was never an us and them. We did things equally and we did things together, but it is now time for that to happen. And, you know, in where my people are from, the Minyibul people, it's actually now the time of the grandmother dreaming. So we call it Mirana Buzrum, which means grandmother dreaming. So now it's the time of the grandfather. He's had to take a big step back, and now it's the time for all our people to sort of nurture and be in that caring space and being around the women and the matriarch to take that lead again. So that's actually written in the stars and in our dreaming, and that's actually happening in a bigger, much bigger space than you know, just looking at cultural fire practices. But you know, just to go back to the importance of women in fire, you know, it's always envisioned that it's a man's job to sort of carry that. But you know, Vanessa, Deb and I are all firefighters, so we're trying to lead that change and show our women that it's definitely an empowering position to be in and to carry that knowledge and to stand strong in your knowledge and your power and being able to implement such things is really powerful.
No matter what she do now, she carried you. No matter who she be now, she carried you,
you.
All the whales, all the wolves, all the snakes, all the spiders, they carried you,
you.
In the hospital bed when they're a weak one or a fighter, they carried you,
you.
No matter who she be now, she carried you,
you.
No matter what she says or doesn't do,
she
carried you.
You.
You don't even have to like her, just look at her and love her and know that she carried you. She too was a child and her little life was wild. You don't know what she went through. You may think that you do. You don't know what she went through. That little girl was you.
You.
She too was a child, and her little life was so wild. You just don't know what she went through.
Well, thank you so much, Vanessa, Deb, and Rachel, for taking the time today. Before we end, is there anything else that you'd like to share?
We've got some, you know, there is some great programs going out there across Australia. Like I said, there's a lot of communities that never stop cultural burns that are now out teaching other communities. We have our National Fire Stick Alliance, which is an Australian National Aboriginal organisation that is working with governments and departments and philanthropists to come together to we're working on a program where we want to train up 100 Aboriginal cultural practitioners across Australia to deploy, to go out and manage country. We want to see more rangers, Aboriginal rangers that are getting paid proper wages to have a full-time job to look after country. We want to share our knowledge with the community. We want to teach people what our elders taught us. It's our obligation to teach. We've got a lot of organisations out there that are doing this work, sometimes quietly in their own, you know, sometimes the broader community don't know what we're doing. But we also have a lot of non-Aboriginal people that are interested and come along to our cultural burns and cultural events to sit together and yarn and learn together. And they're beautiful times and days. And I can see that we will get there and things will get better and we will work together. It's a lot of work in the meantime to sit down and get the bureaucratic Western system and paperwork so that we can roll out and do these things. But I do have faith and hope that we will come together and we will see Aboriginal people out there in permanent jobs looking after country and teaching people about fire and not to be fearful of it. We want to teach children at school, you know, what cultural burns and our cultural practices. They're things to grow up with and learn and not to be scared of. I think together, all Indigenous nations and together sharing our cultural knowledge across the planet and working together as one, we will get there eventually. I just hope to see it in my lifetime. Oh, something I did want to mention, I don't know if any, one of our fire practitioners, Victor Stephenson, that's been pretty, he's actually been to Canada and working with some nations over there. He's released his book, Fire Country. He'd been writing this for the last 3 years and then he just got to release it. And it's how Indigenous fire management could help save Australia. So it's Fire Country by Victor Stephenson.
Yeah, no, thanks for that. Like, I think one thing I would add is that everybody has got the opportunity to support and amplify the voices of Indigenous people around whatever issue that, you know, is happening or, you know, being promoted at that stage. Like a couple of days ago here, there was a group of us that are involved in a local running group, and we heard about the campaign for missing and murdered Indigenous women and a running group over, I think it was in America there, and we sent our support to them and took some photos of us. They were asking everyone to wear red in support of missing and murdered Indigenous women worldwide. So we wore red when we were running and sent photos to that campaign and, you know, put it up on our Twitter feeds and supported, you know. So it's a way that's not just for Indigenous people to do. That's something that all people can get behind and support Indigenous people in the work that we're doing. So that, one, it kind of shares the load a little bit, but it also shows Indigenous people that, you know, that there's allies there and that there are people that are willing to listen and kind of buoys our momentum and our strength. So in terms of the fires, you know, there's probably the biggest Indigenous-led organisation in Australia in relation to the cultural burning is the Fire Sticks Alliance Indigenous Corporation. So if people want to jump onto the Fire Sticks Alliance, I think it's firesticks.org.au, jump onto their website, you know, take a look at some of the videos, watch some of the videos that talk about cultural burning, and that's from a whole range of Indigenous presenters. They've got resources there that people can use in or, you know, just read and learn about cultural burning. There's a book there's a couple of books actually. So there's some publications that people can purchase. They can come along to cultural burning workshops. So the cultural burning workshops, there's a group of them that are run that are open to all people. So it's not just for Indigenous people to participate in. And that's a way that people can come along and learn. Like I take my kids the last couple of years, myself and my children have gone and camped for the week and worked with, you know, worked alongside local Aboriginal people, learning about how they care for country using fire in that local landscape. So especially the, you know, the non-Indigenous fire managers, people who work in those fire departments and agencies and forestry agencies and national parks, they get a lot out of coming to those workshops and just listening to Aboriginal people for that week and letting Aboriginal people have that leadership. So yeah, there's ways that people could learn and get involved and support local Aboriginal people. So, and that doesn't matter if it's fire or if it's water management or if it's, you know, heritage sites or even, like I said, you know, with the missing and murdered Indigenous women, just those social campaigns and social justice campaigns. So there's work for everybody to do here. So I just encourage everyone to, you know, to use their power to be able to support Indigenous people wherever they can.
Yeah, look, it's such a vast sort of space to be talking about, and I'm very passionate about it. You know, I suppose I just want to reiterate that it's you know, the fire regime and being around that good smoke and that healthy smoke really just invigorates the soul and the spirit. But it's more than that as well, because you're looking after the land and you're looking after the country, and you know, like it's a really hard thing to sort of explain, but when you see mob and or when you see, you know, Indigenous people out on country and they're looking after country, it's an overall well-being that changes in them. And it's nothing that I can explain, because it's a visual thing and you can actually see their spirits come alive and you can see, you know, the passion and something that even people who've never been out on country before to look after it or to do anything, can you invite these people along to put in fire or to do different things to manage and look after country? And they always walk away going, wow, I never thought it was like that. And that's because our country responds to our people. And the people respond back to country. And it's almost watching that reconnection of kin through country and people ignite again. So you see that spark happen that's been so suppressed for so long, and it only just takes that one day or that one, you know, project or that one event for them to actually walk away going, oh, and then they feel connected again and belonging again. And so it's such a bigger, it's so big, you know, and it's really hard to sort of capture that space, but that's what I enjoy seeing. I really enjoy seeing that healing in country and healing in people, because that's really powerful and that's empowering, and that makes me go, you know, I'm doing the right thing, and this is where we need to be.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Wild podcast. I'm Ayana Young. The music you heard today was from Santiago Cordoba and Cavalia. I'd like to thank our podcast production team, Francesca Glasspell, Erica Ekram, and Melanie Younger.